Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The telling of American history has undergone a major transformation in the past 50 years, as new perspectives outside the mainstream culture have been recognized and celebrated, not necessarily to diminish the accomplishment of that dominant culture, but to acknowledge that America has always been and remains the proverbial melting pot, a home of many cultures, ethnicities, and creeds who come together to form a unique identity. Islamic and religion scholar Amir Hussein has worked to bring recognition to the fact that Muslims have been and are a part of that tradition from before the country's beginnings. Though small in numbers, their influence on our history and our culture is the story of his 2016 book, Muslims and the Making of America. Philbrook Museum, in conjunction with its exhibit, Wondrous Worlds, Art and Islam Through Time and Space, will present Dr. Hussein in conversation tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at the museum. Amir Hussein is a professor of theological studies at Loyola Marymount University and teaches on world religions and the study of Islam. From 2011 to 2015, he was editor of the Journal of the American Academy of Religion and is the author of a number of scholarly books and texts. He was also an advisor to the television series The Story of God with Morgan Freeman. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Amir Hussein, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for hosting me.
You've been writing most of your scholarly career, textbooks and scholarly articles about world religion and Islam. What led you to write this relatively slender book about the history of Muslims in America?
So thank you for that. The book came out in 2016. I wanted to write the book in 2009 when President Obama, in one of his first visits as president outside the U.S., was in Cairo at Cairo University. And he gave this great talk about America and Islam, and he listed the kinds of things that American Muslims had done. And I thought, you know, I know that because I'm a scholar who works on American Islam. I bet most Americans don't know the first thing about this. And so it's like I have to write something that's much more popular because I'm writing academic scholarly kinds of things. I became the editor of the big journal in our field, the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, for 5 years. So I couldn't, you know, write this book for 5 years. And then 2016 happens. You start seeing the lead up to the election, what was going on there. And it becomes, oh, I really need to get this book out there. And my publisher, you know, Baylor University Press, which was very kindly stuck with me from 2009, was saying, we need to get this book out there. Because then more than ever was this refrain that you heard, you know, A, that Muslims are newcomers, B, that Muslims haven't contributed anything to America, C, at worst, you know, Muslims are some kind of fifth column trying to undermine, and at worst, they're actually trying to take over America. And so it was really important to get this out there to say, for the ordinary person who's not going to pick up a 400-page book with footnotes, what are some of the ways in which Muslims have shaped what it means to be American?
And it seems like this cycle of anti-Muslim sentiment just keeps repeating and repeating and repeating. Sometimes it has something to do with world events. Other times it's just, seems like it's a popular subject for demagoguery.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, if you look at the historical, you know, rivalry between Christians and Muslims, it's sort of no surprise that you have, you know, the European sort of powers, and then the other world is the Islamic world, the Ottoman Turkish, you know, empire. So you have that. In my lifetime, it's been, you know, 1972 with the Arab-Israeli War. It's been 1979 with the Iranian takeover of the U.S. embassy and Americans held hostage. Most tragically, of course, is 9/11 and seeing that kind of thing. So you have those kinds of cycles where there are reasons where you have this. I mean, 9/11 is a great example where 19 Muslims killed, you know, 3,000 Americans. But then you often have that convenient scapegoating sort of thing. If you say, okay, here's this tiny minority, I'm talking about Muslims in America, they're not doing a whole lot, we can blame our troubles on them, when that's not where the troubles are. The troubles are somewhere else.
And what you write in Muslims in the Making of America is, in fact, that Muslims, while still a very small minority, were right next to other slaves, oftentimes, and other working men who built America.
And that's the thing that we don't think about or we don't like to talk about. So it may well have been one of Mrs. Obama's last addresses as First Lady, where she very famously said, I wake up every morning in a house built by slaves. And people lost their minds. And you talk to people and say, well, wait a minute. Who do you think rebuilt the White House after the British burnt it down in 1812? You know, do you think they brought in like Russian stonemasons? You think they brought in Estonian stone cut? No. We use slaves to build that, you know. And this idea that Islam goes back at least to the transatlantic slave trade in America.
Do we have an idea of the percentage of Muslims that came across through the Middle Passage to America?
So it's tough to, you know, do any sort of scholarly work on that because you don't have the kinds of records that you would need. But from the people who've done it, and Sylvain Diouf at the Schomburg Center is amazing for that, they estimate that between 10 and 20% of the West African slaves who were brought over were Muslims. So it's a minority, but it's a significant minority when you think about the number of people who were brought over. And then you start seeing some of those narratives, either people telling them themselves. So one of the most famous is a narrative of a Muslim slave, Omar ibn Said. And he wrote an autobiography in Arabic. That's now at the Library of Congress. And it was this year that the Library of Congress sort of put that up in a really interesting digital way. So anyone, if you go to the Library of Congress website, you can access, I think there's like 30, 35 documents that they have, including like his original Arabic, then the translation, then other kinds of things there. So you have that. You have another famous slave, Job bin Solomon, who comes in 1730. You know, he gets his freedom partly because his owner realizes that he can write, he's literate, he's freed. It's sort of an interesting story. And this, you know, Anglican priest, Reverend Blewett in London, writes this book about this Muslim slave in the Americas. That's published in 1734. So in 1734, long before 1776, when the father of our country, General Washington, is a two-year-old toddler, people in London are reading about this Muslim slave in the Americas.
These are interesting stories, but is there any evidence that 10 to 20% of slaves that came over kept any remnants of their religion? Because when you think of like a lot of the animist religions, that was stamped out by slave owners. And then you see their influence right on the Christianity that sort of took hold.
Absolutely. And so what you had was a lot of these slaves, you know, being forced to convert to Christianity. You see this in some of the slave narratives that we have. You do see survivals of things. And so I'm thinking now of Tim O'Brien's magnificent, you know, the things they carried book. What were the things people carried? What were the things people were buried with? The last time that I teach occasionally at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, and the last time I was there, they put me up at the Calvert House, which is this great hotel that used to be, you know, a mansion there across from the State House. And they had this great exhibit of having done some excavation and some restoration work underneath the building and the foundations, of coming up with objects that the slaves had, one of which was on display there was this hand of Fatima, which is this clearly Islamic symbol. And you say, okay, so at some point in the 1830s, you know, when this was happening, there was some Muslim slaves who had some sense of their Muslimness, you know, there. But very clearly, you know, you couldn't practice openly, you couldn't worship openly, you had to keep that in secret, which meant that in many ways the practices sort of, you know, died out until they were sort of renewed by other folks. And because we've had, I don't mean to get political here, but contrary to the current administration, we've always been a nation of immigrants. We've always welcomed in immigrants here. And so you see people coming, not in huge numbers, but not absent either.
Well, there's a lot of fascinating stories of American history, and some I had no idea. You tell of at least one of the first written encounters of a Muslim and Arabic showing up in the New World shows up when Europeans first come to this shore, and that is Columbus had an Arabic translator, which blew my mind at first. And then, as you write, it says, well, if you didn't know Latin, you didn't know Greek, you had to know Arabic if you were a learned person.
Right. No, and exactly. I mean, we all know in America 1492 because of Columbus. In the rest of the world, 1492 is important because that was the Reconquista. That's when the Jews and the Muslims begin to get expelled from Spain. That's where Spain tries to recast itself in its Catholic.
That's right. Spain, which is the country that sponsors Columbus, had just reclaimed it from the Moors.
Maria Rosa Menocal, who's this brilliant scholar who died far too soon, is this brilliant professor at Yale, writes about this and, you know, mentions the fact that when Columbus set sail, he can't sail from the main port because those ports are busy with the ships, the Jews who are leaving, you know, forced into exile. So Columbus set sails from a minor sort of port. Now, no disrespect to Mr. Columbus, but he thinks he's going the other way. He thinks he's going to India. He doesn't think he's coming to the New World. He wants to do what he needs to do in India because all the spices, all the sort of things to trade for. But he knows that the other language of civilization is Arabic. You know, we're not sure if Columbus spoke Castilian or Latin or that kind of thing. But he brings with him, and Maria Menocal writes about this, Luis de Torres, who's a converso, a Jew who has to convert to Catholicism. Luis de Torres knows both Hebrew and Arabic. And so the fact that Columbus, on the voyage to America, brings an Arab translator, the fact that, you know, the earliest record we have, and we have stories that I'm sure will be proven true down the road of West African Muslim kingdoms, you know, because we know that Islam comes into West Africa in the 9th century. We know those West Africans sailed to what is now the New World, the Americas. We don't have any archaeological evidence of that. We have textual evidence where people will say, yeah, I sent a party out, they went here, they came back. You know, I'm pretty sure we're going to find some evidence of that. But 1528, you have this slave, Estevancio, the Moor, who is a slave of one of the Spanish conquistadors. He comes 1528. He travels in what is now like Arizona, New Mexico, and dies in 1539. And so you think about this, that in 1539, there's a Muslim who's buried in America. That's long before, you know, 1619, 1620, however you date, you know, the U.S. I mean, long before. I mean, obviously, we're here long before 1776.
Right. And the craziest thing you write in this book is that it's not crazy, but it's just mind-boggling that this Arabic translator actually could converse with some of the tribal groups in the Indies.
And that's part of the evidence there, because again, this is Maria Menocal who writes about this in this brilliant book, Shards of Love, Exile and the Origins of the Lyric. It's an amazing, you know, book there. And she talks about the fact that this translator has this conversation with this, you know, Taino chief in what is now like Cuba, mm-hmm. you know. And it's like, well, wait, how does this guy know Arabic? Is that some evidence for the fact that, yeah, you would have had these West Africans who would have come into those spaces and knowing those kinds of languages? You know, it's phenomenal, but we don't think about that, you know. We don't think about all the strands of our history. We just think about the dominant.
My guest today is Amir Hussain. He's a professor of theological studies at Loyola Marymount University, the author of Muslims and the Making of America. Philbrook, in conjunction with their exhibit, Wondrous Worlds, Art and Islam Through Time and Place, will present Dr. Hussain tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock, talking about his book, Muslims and the Making of America. And there's a number of stories in this book. You teach at Navy, I guess, from time to time, And I assure you, you've taught future Marines what that second part of the first line of the Marines hymn goes, of the shores of Tripoli. And this is a big story. This is the U.S. government's first engagement with the Muslim world.
As a country after the War for Independence, you know, it's exactly that. And
we're talking about the shores of Tripoli.
The shores of Tripoli, absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, I grew up in Canada. I knew about the Marines, obviously. Then you come to Los Angeles, and from the halls of Montezuma, I understand why that's there. We're 3 hours from the Mexican border to the shores of Tripoli. And I'm thinking, wait, why are we talking about Libya? What's the American presence in Libya? And then you go to, it's now at the Naval Academy, what's called they call it the Libyan Monument, sometimes called the Tripoli Monument. It's our oldest war monument in the United States, carved in Italy in 1804. Brought to the U.S. in 1806, displayed first at the Navy Yard in D.C., then moved to the Capitol, and then moved, I can't remember, I think in 1860 or so, to where it is now, at the Academy in Annapolis. And that's this monument to the Barbary Coast War, which is our first engagement as an independent country there. And to think, okay, you've got that, and you have these images of, you know, the Turks, as Muslims were then known. Those may be some of the first images of Muslims, you know, in the U.S., and that's 1806 where this sculpture is brought to America.
You write in the introduction, and you spend a good deal of the book talking about the two people you say, the two American Muslims that have had the most influence on you.
Yeah.
One was Muhammad Ali. That seems pretty evident for a Muslim in America, right, or in the New World.
Right.
The second is less notable, but equally notable in its own way, and that is Atlantic Records owner Ahmet Erdogan. Right. So tell us about these two people. Why are these the most influential in your life?
Well, and so the influential ones for – and they're for me, and I can make the case of why they're influential for others. But let me start with Muhammad Ali. Like, I was a Muslim kid growing up in Toronto in the 1970s. You didn't see a lot of brown people on television, forget about what religion they were. The only Muslim that I really saw on TV was Muhammad Ali. And at that point, he'd, you know, made the conversion. He was 10 years into the conversion from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali. So I didn't know that backstory of, you know, the conversion, the name change, the refusal in 67 for induction to the Vietnam War. I learned that later on. Ali, to this day, remains the greatest athlete I've ever seen. I mean, just the physical presence, the skills that that man had there. And then, you know, 1996, the Atlanta Olympics, such a powerful moment because, you know, everyone thought that Janet Evans was going to be the one to light the cauldron. And then the curtain parts and there's this old man whose arm is shaken with the Parkinson's who Janet gives a torch to. And it's Muhammad Ali. And a hush goes over the crowd. And it's like, that's Muhammad Ali. That's him. And you see this kind of thing. So when he dies in 2016, and it was really lovely because I was literally just finishing up the book and was able to go back and talk about him, unfortunately, in the past tense because he passed away. But you think about that this may well have been the most famous man in the world in the pre-internet age. But then you think about the changes that he was able to do, you know, the refusal for induction to the Vietnam War in 1967 was not a popular thing in 67, 74, a very different kind of thing, but 67, not so much, and always, you know, standing up there. And then towards the end of his life, very much being this sort of ambassador for Islam, doing the kinds of things. So I think with Ali, so important because you cannot say that Muhammad Ali was not an American. He, sui generis, he came out of this place. Only America could have produced Muhammad Ali, you know, and that's so important there. But I think most people know about him. For me, as a music fan, it's Atlantic Records, you know, and I would argue, and I will argue with historians, that you cannot understand the history of America in the 20th century, not the history of American music, but the history of America in the 20th century, without looking at Atlantic Records. And then you think about, how did this company come to existence? Well, it's a Muslim guy, Ahmet Erdogan, whose father, Mehmet Munir Erdogan, is the second ambassador of the Republic of Turkey to the U.S. He, Ahmet, comes with his family to D.C. D.C. in the 1930s is not a surprisingly, you know, cosmopolitan place. He's just come from London because his dad was, you know, the ambassador to the court of St. James's, you know, the fancy name they give to, you know, right, the court in London there. And so it's a funny moment. You imagine like this adolescent kid who's just come from London to D.C. and all of a sudden D.C. is like this sleepy little town. And so he goes off looking for adventure, which you can do when your dad's a diplomat. He goes in the black neighborhoods near Howard University. He listens to this music that he's first heard in London. One of Ahmet Erdogan's sort of claims to fame is that as a young boy in London, he was the first person to ask Ella Fitzgerald for her autograph when she was performing as a young singer in London, you know. And so there he is. But this is the 1930s. This is race music, you know. This is not stuff that white people listen to. This is stuff that black people listen to. So he, you know, goes to school, actually goes to St. John's, you know, in Annapolis, then starts doing some work at Georgetown in D.C. His father dies. And the question comes up, you know, is the family going to go back to Turkey? Are they going to stay there? He's already in Georgetown. He wants to stay in D.C. So with his Jewish friends, with a loan from his dentist, you know, they start Atlantic Records. And that's, for me, the crucial thing, that if you look at the Atlantic R&B sides of the 50s, if you look at the Atlantic soul sides of the 60s and the 70s, that's American music. That's Otis Redding. That's, they sign Ray Charles, you know, in right, the 60s. And it writes, you know, Mess Around for Ray Charles. they do this amazing kind of thing. His brother is really involved in the jazz world and doing, you know, kinds of things there.
The British rockers wanted to come and be on Atlantic because of that connection to the American R&B.
Absolutely, because that's what they listened to. And the fact that the Stones really wanted to be a blues band, you know, and it's funny because they come back to that. But he signs, you know, the Rolling Stones for the distribution rights for Rolling Stones records. He signs, you know, Led Zeppelin to Atlantic Records. He's the chairman of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He won a major award, you know, from the Library of Congress precisely for his contributions to American culture. And American music wouldn't be what it is without Atlantic Records, founded by this Turkish Muslim.
And of course, the pop side.
Oh, absolutely.
Subsidized his real love, which was jazz.
Jazz and the blues. And that's the kind of, you know, if you look at what is American music, but really jazz and blues, you know, in terms of coming up with really interesting kinds of things there. And exactly, you can do the popular records or even, like, you know, like I said, the soul records in the 60s and 70s. That's what lets you do the jazz records that, you know, those of us who love jazz love, but you're not selling 10 million copies of this jazz record.
My guest today is Amir Hussain. He's a professor of theological studies at Loyola Marymount University and the author of Muslims and the Making of America, which he'll be discussing at Philbrook Museum tomorrow evening in conjunction with their exhibit, Wondrous Worlds, Art and Islam Through Time and Place. I want to ask you about something you mentioned earlier. He says, you know, as you were growing up in Toronto, it was like, and this is a question for all people of color in the United States, is only at certain points do you see your people represented in the mainstream culture. And you said for you, Muhammad Ali was this first Muslim that you could see in popular culture. You know, how long did it go before you began to see characters of Islamic background in mainstream culture other than Muhammad Ali?
No, and that's it. That, you know, I do some work on religion in the media. And so you look at who's the first sort of regular South Asian character on television. Well, that's Kavi Raz, who plays this doctor on St. Elsewhere, you know, this you know, TV show in the 80s about this, you know, hospital setting. What's the first regular Muslim character on television? Well, it's Tom Fontana, who does Oz for HBO. And we've forgotten about Oz. I mean, everyone looks at Game of Thrones, Sopranos. Well, the first thing that HBO did as a dramatic series was Oz. You know, Oswald Correctional Institute, Tom Fontana, who'd done cop shows, talks about the fact that, yeah, when you do a cop show ends when the bad guy goes to jail. What happens when the bad guy goes to jail? And especially in America, especially here in Oklahoma, where you've got, you know, prison populations here. And so this was, you know, 20 years ago that he's doing this. And he says, okay, let me do the show about prisons. And if you're in prison, you got to join a gang to survive, whether that's the Aryan Nation, whether that's the Mexican Mafia, the Mafia, or the Black Muslims. And so he has to have this Black Muslim character. And so Eamon Walker, funny enough, a British guy, you know, plays this American Muslim character. You know, now you see so many changes, you know, with the way in which television works. So like Rami Youssef, this, you know, Arab comedian, has this show on Hulu. He wouldn't have had that show 2 years ago. You know, Kumail Nanjiani with this sort of breakout, you know, the Big Sick. Who would have thought that a Muslim immigrant, you know, from Pakistan would have the breakout romantic comedy of a couple of years ago, you know, so you do that. But I think that's the thing, whether you're a person of color, whether you're a woman, whether you're an LGBT person, you remember the first time you saw someone that was like you on TV.
So if I can take this back to Muhammad Ali, this is why he may have had this worldwide influence, because even in other cultures, he might be that first Muslim.
Well, absolutely. But and the other part with Ali was he was also, I mean, we can talk about, you know, who was the first global sort of superstar. But part of what made Ali appealing around the world was that he fought around the world. And so, you know, in the less enlightened times of the 70s, I remember as a 10-year-old kid watching The Rumble in the Jungle with George Foreman in Zaire. You know, so you're fighting in Zaire, you're fighting in the Philippines, you're fighting in Canada, you're doing, you know, all these kinds of things around the world in a way in which you don't see that. And to this day,
of course, part of that was because he couldn't fight in the United States while his case was being adjudicated.
Court case, exactly, doing that kind of thing. But I think that also gave him a sense of the global situation, because I think, and I'm not saying it in any kind of negative way, I think for so many Americans, because this is such a big and powerful country, you don't ever leave America, so you don't think about the rest of the world. And all of a sudden you realize, oh yeah, there's a whole other world outside of America. But I think, you know, just this idea that, you know, we don't tell all those kinds of stories. And so if you remember a couple of years ago when Hidden Figures came out, you know, this wonderful movie about these black women who basically did the math to get John Glenn into space. Well, Octavia Spencer, who's in the film, tells the story where when she got the script, she thought, oh, this is a lovely story, but it's fiction. And then begin to realize, no, this is actually a true story. And then thinking, wait, I'm a black woman. If I don't know the story of black women who did this, why would I expect anyone else to know this story? And I think that becomes the real key that, you know, you have so many stories told by, you know, dominant cultures, dominant narratives. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. What I'm saying is that, you know, other people have stories.
And those stories have been lost or are only now being rediscovered.
Absolutely.
Well, you're going to be speaking at Philbrook in conjunction with this exhibit, looking at Islamic art. It's interesting, in your book, you talk about the influence of Islamic architecture. And when you think of it, its influence on American art, it's probably in architecture.
Right.
And it's interesting, it's probably in plain sight and you don't even see it for the most part. And the story you tell has to go to the Shrine Auditorium, which there are numerous Shriner lodges and Masonic that all owe its architecture to Islamic.
Well, absolutely. And it was same thing a couple of years ago. I was in Atlanta for a board meeting of the American Academy of Religion, and we're walking by this building, and it's like, it's this mosque. And I'm like, why is there this giant mosque in the middle of downtown Atlanta? And why have I never heard of this? And then it's like, I think it's called the Syria Theater. And it's like, oh, right, it's not a mosque. This is one of those buildings built by the Shriners. And so I tell the story in the book of a friend who's an exchange who actually came to USC as one of the best architecture schools in the country. And he comes from Pakistan to study architecture. He knows that there's a mosque across the campus. And he goes across Jefferson Avenue to what he thinks is the mosque. And if you've seen the Shrine Auditorium with the two big domes, you can see why he's, you know, confused about this. And is told, no, sir, this is not the mosque. The mosque is actually on Vermont Avenue. This is the Shrine Auditorium. So you have that kind of thing. So that's the kind of visible architecture. But then you have the kinds of things that we don't think about, that the fact that, you know, not an architect, but a structural engineer, Fazlur Rahman Khan, who worked for Skidmore, Merrill, Owings in Chicago, came to this country like many Muslims do to go to school, went to the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, studied engineering, became the structural engineer. He was the guy that made the construction of these tall buildings possible. So you look at the Sears Tower, you look at the John Hancock Building. Can you understand the Chicago skyline without those two buildings? Well, those two buildings wouldn't have been able to be built were it not for this, you know, structural engineer from Bangladesh who is a Muslim who comes up with this idea. And so, you know, we can talk about, 19 Muslims destroyed the World Trade Center, completely changed the landscape of America. But this other Muslim made possible the construction of those tall buildings. And we don't know him. How many of us remember Fazlur Rahman Khan? You know, we've all been, if you've been to Chicago, you've seen the Sears Tower. I mean, I think it's the Willis Tower or something. I'd still call it the Sears Tower. You know, the John Hancock Building. That's iconic American architecture made possible by this American Muslim.
The name of the book is Muslims in the Making of America. You can learn more tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Philbrook. You can learn more at philbrook.org. Amir Hussain, thanks very much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Amir Hussain is a professor of theological studies at Loyola Marymount University and the author of the 2016 book, Muslims and the Making of America. He'll be talking about the book tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at Philbrook Museum in conjunction with their exhibit, Wondrous Worlds, Art and Islam Through Time and Place. For information on the event, visit philbrook.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.